This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. My co-host, Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And today we're going to talk about one of my specialties, which is the French Revolution, and in particular, both what it is and also how it relates to military affairs. So I will turn the hosting over to Dr. Nance.
Okay, so you kind of started the first question with it, which is, what is the French Revolution? And then maybe as we get on there, like, why do we care?
Yeah, and we'll circle back to that second question at the end, because I think that's an important aspect of all this. The answer to that question is complicated, and it's more complicated than many questions we ask in history, simply because the French Revolution is a really important event. I argue it's the single most important event in world history between the rise of Protestant Christianity and probably the advent of the nuclear weapons in 1945, although you could argue it has much more important ramifications than even that. In large part because during the French Revolution, just about every form of political structure and socio-political organization was at least attempted, and to some degree or another, or in some cases with the more radical versions of it, they kind of stem from experiments in the French Revolution. This, by the way, is why the American War of Independence is not as important as a world event, because the American War of Independence, and note I'm not calling it the American Revolution, basically just transitioned America from a kind of quasi-republican colonial government to a quasi-republican American government. So the French Revolution is the result of essentially the failure of the French state. What's called the old regime, the French monarchy of the Capetian family, the Bourbon branch by the 18th century. They lose a couple wars in the 18th century. They're broke. That's a big problem. And their government structures just aren't set up to handle the massive debt that they incur, and in large part because of their support of the Americans in the American War of Independence. On top of that, there are deeper social issues. What we might call a political or even a class consciousness has been awoken among French people, particularly the, you know, probably 26 of the 28 million French people who didn't belong to a privileged group. And if you notice me saying this in Marxist terms, it's because, lest we forget, Marx was a historian of the French Revolution, among other things. So this is coming out of that.
Okay, so let's start there. So France has had many issues throughout its very long history.
Yep.
And but France is actually one of the oldest uniquely identified states, one might even say a nation, during this time frame.
Yep.
So what you said is something awakened in the populace. So what's different between France of the 1770s, 1780s, and say France of earlier times, of earlier crises?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I don't think that there is an answer that will satisfy every listener. France has many crises in its past, as you point out. There is a polity that we recognize as France or West Francia dating back to the 9th century. And there are times in which that polity looks like it will cease to exist. Under the Ottonian dynasties of Germany, it seems like West Francia might go away. Under the Angevins, English people familiar with English history will know as the Plantagenets, it seems like it might happen. Most famously during the kind of the middle phase of the Hundred Years' War, actually, the King of England is technically the King of France for about a decade. That's Henry VI of England. And then during the Wars of Religion in the 16th century, you have some of the same issues. So that's a really good question. Why did France fall apart in the 1780s and not in other times? And it's a combination of the context of the time and, frankly, just luck. You know, in prior periods, the luck seemed to turn. Or if you believe French historians, one of the common themes of French history is what's known as the Man of Destiny, who is sometimes a woman.
Joan of Arc, no.
Right. Jeanne d'Arc, great example. Who just shows up and fixes France, right? It's probably the most recent example of that is Charles de Gaulle to a lot of people. That France is kind of a mess during World War II and after, and Charles de Gaulle shows up a couple times and puts it back together. Not everybody agrees with that, but you get the idea. So I think if I had to characterize it based on a whole lot of people arguing about this, I would say that the two things that are different, one, most of all, it's the awakening of people to reality and to realities. In the 18th century, a lot of French writers like Voltaire spent a lot of time pointing out how silly the French system is and how much better other systems like the English system are. Because in England, at least people have an idea of having a voice in government. Never mind that most of them don't, but at least there's an idea there. And of course, then America comes along and does it more or less the same way. Add to that rising literacy rates, rising availability of literature, particularly political and social analyses of the French state. Add to that the fact that there are fewer people engaged in supporting the monarchy. In prior crises, people kind of came around eventually to rescuing France. But in the 1780s, there's less of a sense that they're doing that. And then finally, it just kind of happened that way. You know, that's not a satisfactory answer to anybody, but in history, often that is the right answer.
So let's kind of, we can spend a lot of time talking about about kind of the different interpretations and analyses, and we can kind of put that towards the end. But what I'd like to do is just kind of step us through the basic sequence of events. How did this kind of go down, and where do you start the story of the French Revolution?
Yeah, so this is funny, and you can't see it, but I'm laughing. I'm reminded of an experiment that my doctoral advisor, Dr. Mike Legere, did with his grad students when I was at the University of North Texas, where he had us sit down and figure out how many soldiers the French lost in Spain, in the Napoleonic invasion of Spain. We spent a month arguing over when the campaign began, and then we quit. And I'm laughing because traditionally the French Revolution begins in the summer of 1789, usually with the storming of the Bastille. The Bastille is one of the many political prisons in the kingdom, and it's kind of a symbol of royal repression to a lot of people. But more recently, and by recently I mean within the last 50 years, a lot of people have kind of looked askance at that. And there's a wonderful book by a French historian named Jean Negret. It's called The Pre-Revolution. And what he pointed out is you can kind of start the revolution in 1787. And what happens there is a group of nobles, so the leading families of the kingdom, including members of the royal family, like the Orléans branch, they get together and they decide that the king, Louis XVI, is not running the state correctly. They want to go back to a noble-led kingdom, kind of the Commonwealth idea of the pre-early modern, kind of late medieval state.
And Louis XIV, of course, is kind of the turning point from shifting.
Louis XIII, roughly. Louis XIV, yeah. 17th century, right. Now, they're selfishly interested. They think they're the best people to run France, but in the end, they want to run France. So you have this two-year period from 1787 to 1789, what's often referred to as the aristocratic revolt or even the aristocratic revolution.
So this is a power struggle between nobles, essentially.
Right, exactly. And the person who wins is a cardinal named Loménie de Brienne, who's actually in opposition. Then he becomes the first minister, and he's repressing the nobles for the king. But he realizes the financial situation is hopeless. So at that point, the only solution is to call the Estates General. Now, the Estates General is a traditional meeting of the three estates of the realm. The first is the clergy, first duty to God. The second is the nobility, second duty to the crown. The third is everybody else. So the nobility is about 0.5% of the population. The clergy is about 0.5%. The nobility about 1.5%, which means the third estate is 98%. So then we're getting into 1788, 1789. And that's when the average people start to speak up. And this is why a lot of people say 1789, because a lot of mid-20th century analysis, both in French and then in English, is focused on history from below, the Annalise School, Marxist interpretations. It's all about the people.
Now, let's parse that a little bit more, because when we say the people, particularly in an American context, we think of la-di-da-di everybody, you know, from the poor man on the street all the way up to the rich banker.
Yep.
But that's not necessarily, but the in France in particular, there's a couple different gradations in there.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting thing that it, in many ways kind of belies a Marxist class interpretation of what's happening. although a lot of sophisticated Marxists would argue an estate is not a class, but we don't have to go too far down that rabbit hole. In France, money does not influence your social standing. That's the key thing for Americans to understand. America tends to think of a privilege of wealth or a nobility of wealth even. Think of a family like the Gates family, right? A lawyer whose son becomes one of the richest people in the country because he went to an elite school, right? And then founded a software company. But that's not how it would work in France. So in the nobility, in the second estate, there are very poor people. And in fact, the average noble by 1789 is very poor, which is one of the reasons you have social conflict.
And because they are coming, because they're gaining their wealth from the traditional manner of they own land, and right. they're gaining their wealth from that. They're not gaining it through commerce or anything along those lines.
Yes, and technically it is illegal for a French noble to earn money. They can only profit from what are called the feudal dues of the estate that they technically don't own, because the king technically owns all the land, but it's not improper to describe it that way. Now, the third estate, the commoners, ranges from some of the wealthiest people in the kingdom. So during his life, Voltaire was probably the richest person in France. He got there by rigging the national lottery, basically.
As one does.
Right. All the way down to the most destitute, the poorest, you know, the orphan, the homeless person. So that's the third estate. And one of the reasons the French Revolution happens is there's an increasing disparity between the people who have wealth and the people who have power.
So this is an interesting conversation. Where does power come from? Does it come from the ancient ideals of divine right? Does this come from money? Does it come from controlling the military?
Right.
And we can kind of parse those things apart.
Well, and the interesting thing there is, almost without exception, the answer to that within any individual or group is power comes from the place that gives me power, right? The French Revolution is full of lofty ideals, but it's also full of people pursuing their own aggrandizement. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You know, if you are a wealthy merchant and you will never attain nobility, meaning power, it kind of makes sense that you'd want to change the system to your own benefit. Whereas also if you're a noble who's broke but has a title, it makes sense that you would want to change the system to make it to where you could be both wealthy and have a title, right?
So we started off where nobles are upset with how the king is running the country. They want more power and also probably a little bit more money.
Right.
And now we're at the calling the Estates General because the government is broke.
Yeah, so the Estates General is a meeting of the three estates, and it is not a legislature. That's really important. A lot of people, particularly historians from England and America, mistake that it's a legislature. It's not. It's a consultative body. However, they have the example of British Parliament and the new American Congress. And remember, during most of this, America is rewriting its constitution, right? It went from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, which is something the French are very interested in. So a lot of people are looking at their traditional consultative meeting of the Estates General. The estates gather, and then they make proposals to the king as an estate, usually the first and second ally against the third. And they're looking at that and saying, why can't that become a parliament? Why can't we become a constitutional monarchy? And there's a lot of debates going into 1789 about how this should work. In particular, within the third estate, there's a group of people who argue that the 98% deserve to have a greater voice. So normally the way the Estates General works is each estate gets a vote. And as I said, the two votes, first and second, clergy and nobility, outweigh the third.
And because those are the traditional sources of power, where they've been intertwined with each other for literally centuries.
Right, and as anybody who has studied any history over any period of time knows, the few in power usually conspire to keep their power against the many. That's kind of the theme of human history, right? So going into the meeting, which will happen in May of 1789, a lot of people are saying we need to vote by person. They call it vote by head, because there are people who attend this. So let's let them vote as if they're delegates. And we need to give the third estate double the number of representatives of the other two estates, so that the 600 members of the third estate will outweigh the combined 600 members of the first and second estates. So they start meeting in May, and it goes relatively well. There's a lot of fighting over technicalities. The king is there, it's fine. And then over the summer and into the fall, things kind of go off the rails.
And this is Louis XVI.
This is Louis XVI. And Louis XVI plays a key role here. Louis XVI is a well-intentioned, very pious man. He liked to make clocks. It was kind of his hobby. And he wasn't really, you know, he certainly wasn't his predecessors. He wasn't Louis XV, who could be mercurial, but definitely ran the government. He certainly wasn't Louis XIV, who was powerful enough to run the state with a group of five men as his main advisors. Louis XVI is kind of a ditherer. So throughout the summer, there's different people in his ear. And some of them are saying, you need to put a stop to all this. So he starts gathering troops around the capital, and things start to get more and more radical. As I mentioned, a mob will storm the Bastille. Of course, on the 14th of July, 1789, it's always portrayed as this kind of great event that launches the revolution. In reality, they found seven prisoners there. Not a single one of them, I think, could be characterized as a political prisoner.
So let's kind of dwell with this point for just a minute. So the king is understanding that there's a lot of chaos and confusion going on, arguing about what to do. Mm-hmm. Because the problem they're, of course, trying to solve is, how does France get more money?
Right.
So why do things become more radical? What's going on in here that's radicalizing these people?
Well, so for one, there are radicals. There are people like the Abbé Sieyès. Abbé is a monk, basically, who are writing things about how we need a complete social revolution. The Third Estate needs to run the country because the Third Estate is the country. All the way to the radical royalists who are saying, no, we need to go back to this kind of imagined crypto monarchy when the king ran everything by himself.
So we're having guys that want to burn it all down.
Right.
All the way to, why are we even listening to these people?
Right, exactly.
So and let's kind of play with this, because you said Louis XVI was a bit of a dither. Why doesn't he, it sounds like the problem is with the Estates General, so why doesn't he just simply stop?
Yeah, so this is a good question. I think it's a combination of his personality wasn't suited to it. His predecessors, 15, 14, 13, maybe not 12, certainly 11, they would have put their boot on the neck of the people in charge to one degree or another, in one way or another. So 13 would have allowed one of his advisors, like Richelieu, to do it. But that was not 16. I think that's just a personality thing. And I also think he was genuinely interested in reform. So, for example, he issues an edict in the early 1780s that allows tolerance for Protestants. This is a really radical thing for a very Catholic country. So there's that aspect of his personality. And there's also the fact that he just, you know, to borrow the Godfather phrase, he's not a wartime king. He would have been fine presiding over one of the 20-year reigns of France in, like, I don't know, pick a decade when France was, like, didn't have a major crisis. You know, like early, I don't know. Let's call it early 1500s to pick a random time. He probably could have handled that, although there's some wars that are about to happen to him. But you need a strong king who either can seize the revolution and lead France into a kind of English-style constitutional monarchy, or you need a Louis XIV who probably would have killed a lot of people, right? Louis XVI is not those things. And the absence of power allows the different groups to build power around themselves.
Okay, so we have the radical ends. So in this kind of situation, you can kind of pull towards one radical end, you can pull towards another radical end, or there might be moderation towards the center.
Mm-hmm.
We know which way it went, so why didn't the moderation towards the center happen?
So one of the things that happens very early kind of hijacks the process. So you have the storming of the Bastille, and then continuing throughout the summer and into the fall, you have what's known as the Great Fear, where you have these mobs of commoners all around the country who are essentially acting on what we would now call conspiracy theories. The idea that the king has brought in these criminals from outside the country or emptied out the jails, and they're coming for the people of France. There's no truth to it, but it's classic conspiracy theory. They do two very important things. One, they make it to where there is an immediate crisis, people are dying. And two, they attack noble estates. And interestingly, they're not after the nobles. They're after the tax rolls. Because every noble estate has a roll that says how much tax each person owes on their property, to the lord, to the state, whatever. That culminates kind of in the fall, but as a part of that process, the Estates General becomes the National Assembly. So you got these two things operating. You got a national level thing happening. The National Assembly becomes a legislature. The king okays it. He says, all right, everybody go meet. You're just one parliament. And then you got the Great Fear running kind of simultaneously.
And this Great Fear is started because you have people that are rabble-rousing through pamphlet or through verbal means.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, to use an example from relatively recent American history, imagine if an event like January 6th, the storming of the Capitol, imagine if that happened in every noble estate in France. Because, not every noble estate, but a good number of them. And it kind of happened the same way. It's a political rally or just a meeting that somebody decides needs to be more than it is, and then, you know, everybody follows.
So, and we're seeing this steady transition where as the king calls the Estates General, you kind of put a focus on it, and then as people are starting to focus on that, and that focus is then spreading out throughout the countryside as well.
So this is the great challenge that the people in Paris have. Technically, they're in Versailles. The challenge that people trying to run the country have is the whole point of transitioning from a monarchy, a kind of an absolutist monarchy, to a democracy, republic, constitutional monarchy, is you're giving people more choice, right? Well, if you're one of the, you know, probably 28 million French people by that point, and you're sitting on your farm and you're still being oppressed by feudal taxes, and bear in mind, the average French person paid probably 95% of their income in taxes. It's a very regressive tax system. You're being told that you're being given more choice at Versailles, except you're not feeling it. So why don't you go act out your choice? This is the tension of every government between security and liberty, right? You have to maintain some security, or else you just have a crypto-anarchic libertarian state where everybody can do everything and you don't have a state, right? So those two kind of meet on the night of August the 4th and 5th. So a group of the more radical members meet of the National Assembly, and they decide nobility needs to be abolished. And they decide to do it that night. And I would argue that's the real start of the revolution. At that point, something revolutionary has happened. Nobility no longer exists. That will be followed in a couple of years by a list called The Rights of Man and the Citizen, written by Marquis de Lafayette, which guarantees some basic rights. And it's of course modeled after the Bill of Rights from America, because Lafayette spent time in America. But what you've done there is you have made the average French person equal before the law, which is the basis of an egalitarian government. You have moved from being a subject to being a citizen on the night of 4 and 5 August. And laws will be passed later to actually do all these things.
So let's, I just want to pull on this for a little bit, because there's something there, because there's some structure that led up to this point. So you mentioned Voltaire, you mentioned a couple others. So let's talk just very briefly kind of about the intellectual history that has led up to this very radical idea that all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, it's both radical and it's not. One of the things that particularly Americans have to understand is most people in the world in the 1780s, when America's writing its constitution, believe in monarchy. They believe that monarchy, where you have a leader, a monarch, and people are subjects of the monarch, is the way society should be ordered. In large part because whatever their religious system is tends to order society that way, right? If you think about the major religions and religious systems in the world at that time, Christianity preaches that, Islam preaches that, Hinduism preaches that, and Hinduism has the whole attached social structure, right? The caste system, as well as other religions that are perhaps less subscribed but kind of end in the same place, as well as philosophical systems that do that. So outside of a few places like Switzerland, there's really nobody in the world before the American independence in 1783 who say, we should have a truly egalitarian state. But there are people who write about it. Rousseau is the most famous example. Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is one of the great philosophers of the French Enlightenment. He's Swiss. And he is really getting at this idea that a monarchic government just simply can't provide liberty. And other people like Voltaire question the practice of monarchic government. Montesquieu is another influence. He says, hey, we need to have a government that has what he calls a middle institution. We need arbitrators between the crown and the people. We need checks and balances. And of course, you have the great example of England, where you have a government after 1789 where the representatives of the people, Parliament, is supreme. Now, the English system, even today, doesn't really have checks and balances. But it's all those principles that are kind of coalescing.
The idea of equality before the law, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
The idea of one person, one vote, to some degree or another.
Yeah, and the one person, one vote one, I would argue, belongs more to the mid-19th century. But those ideas have been planted. And the revolutionaries reference all of these ideas verbatim. They walk through all this. There are probably millions of books written on the philosophy of the revolutionaries, starting with the revolutionaries themselves.
So the reason I wanted to come back to this is all of this intellectual idea is fermenting and flowing at the same time as all these political and power shifts are going on.
Yes, and this leads us to problems. So over the next couple of years, things calm down a little bit. There are some civil unrest problems. The Great Fear kind of continues. There's a few massacres of people. Like at one point, Lafayette gains control of the government and just starts randomly massacring people in the city and in the prisons in particular. Lafayette's not the hero in France that he is in America. By 1791, they have a constitution. And everything's fine, right? Like, we've had our glorious revolution. We're good to go.
There's a king. There's a something of a legislature. Yep. And now there's a constitution.
Yeah. The problem is, the Constitution of 1791 is often referred to as the bourgeois constitution. What it did was it divided France, it divided French people into two categories. So we're still going to have a king, we're going to have a national assembly, it's actually going to be called a legislative assembly that runs the country, and people are going to elect representatives to the legislative assembly. Except, not everybody's going to be able to vote. And in fact, the vast majority of people will not be able to participate in the government. Because to participate, to be what they call an active citizen, you have to be male, French of course, an adult, and you have to have a certain amount of property. The same restrictions that Americans place on participation in government under the Constitution in the 1790s. White, adult, male, property holder. Just swap French for American. Not an accident. Again, the people in power will almost always seek to stay in power, right? So they produce this constitution that has this bifurcation between active and passive citizens. And I forget the numbers, but the number of active citizens is relatively small. It's dwarfed by the number of passive citizens.
When you think about the large number of peasant farmers that are out there, yeah. The number of factory workers, mm-hmm. You can't help but not.
Right, and those people have spent the last 3 years following this process. And they get the Constitution, and they're looking at it, and they're thinking, we just traded a nobility of birth for a nobility of wealth.
And a lot of these folks have been basically the shock troops to create the right fear conditions of fear to allow the this legislative or the this legislative assembly to form.
Yeah, and so those people decide that they want to speak up, and they increasingly agitate against the government. The other thing that the revolutionaries do that is a colossal mistake. So at a certain point, the National Assembly becomes the Legislative Assembly. In France, they usually refer to both of them as a Constituent Assembly. But what the revolutionaries did is they were trying to create a new government out of nothing, perhaps inspired by America. But they banned people who sat in the National Assembly from being in the Legislative Assembly. So I'm going to borrow a more modern example here. You spent time in Iraq. When we said that no Ba'athist could run the Iraqi government after 2003, what did it do to Iraq?
Gutted all of its basic keeping the lights on structure. Right.
So if all of these really smart people, these political leaders and agitators and lawyers came together to write this new constitution, you can imagine what it's like if you say none of you can be in the new government. All right, who's left?
Well, that to take the American example, it's like telling Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, everybody along those lines and saying, congratulations, you wrote the Constitution, now go home.
Right, you can't serve in it. All right, let's go get Joe off his farm. He's now going to be president.
Which actually brings up the interesting question. This might help answer that, which is, in the U.S., as you say, much the same voting restrictions at first as what's in France. So why in France is there a second wave, third wave, fourth wave, however you want to count the waves?
Yep.
And in the United States, where there are minor relatively upheavals, there isn't a major upheaval.
Yeah, so I would say what happens is that America does have the same upheaval. It just takes a couple decades, right? Because Jefferson is kind of a populist. He reduces some of the property qualifications. And then Jackson, who is a major populist, comes along and gets rid of a lot of them. But of course, some of those will go and some of them will stay. Right? In France, there's a couple of added things, and one of those has to do with what you and I do as military historians. The first is that the American process was not really subscribed to by the average person in an active way, right? So the Constitution was written by people who were very smart and well-educated and privileged, I think pretty much universally. They're lawyers who went to, you know, they read at the best inns or went to the best schools. In France, that's not true. I mean, those people are present, but you also have the voice of the people. They have been primed to participate, whether with their feet or with their voices. And two, the more this goes on, the more Louis decides that he may need to do something about it, and maybe something drastic, in particular because he has essentially been reduced to a figurehead in the 1791 Constitution. He has relatives, as does his wife, Marie Antoinette, the princess of the House of Habsburg. He has relatives in Europe who are very interested in his fate, in particular in Prussia and Austria. By the time the Constitution of 1791 is put into force late that year, there are Prussian and Austrian armies gathering. And there's this kind of brinksmanship process of the revolutionary government on one side and the Austrian and Prussian governments on the other side, kind of one-upping each other for, if you don't change, we're going to start a war.
And there's and of course, we haven't, this is a good time to bring in the international side as well, which is, while all this is going on in France, which is a major, significant country in Europe, the other powers of Europe are looking at this with some trepidation and not really wanting this to get out and to spread.
Right. Yeah, it's worth pointing out. France is the largest, most populous, wealthiest, and probably most economically advanced country in Europe in the 1780s, understanding that most of Russia is not in Europe and that England has not yet gotten its industrial might off the ground. That'll happen in the next century. So yeah, this is not the American, as Americanists call it, the American Revolution happening in some distant colony. This is happening in Europe, and they do not want it to spread. Because we have changed the social structure, right? There are no more nobles. So as this happens, you have these different factions emerge. You have a royalist faction, you have a constitutionalist faction, and then you have a couple right-wing factions. Left-wing factions. And the two main left-wing factions are the Girondins, who are kind of... I probably would get a lot of static for calling them center-left, but for our purposes, let's just say that works. And then you have the far-left, who are the Jacobins. And they're named after... a Jacobin is the French term for an order of monks. They meet at an old monastery, so they're called Jacobins. Jacobins are very good at turning the people out. And the Jacobins are, by and large, people who are not privileged. They're not the people who were in charge of the first part of this process. So what happens as we get into 1792 is, so we've seen the aristocratic revolt, we had the bourgeois revolt, which resulted in the Constitution, now we're getting into the popular revolt. Now some people are going to die.
More people.
A lot more people. So in 1792, the Jacobins and the Girondins in particular are kind of pushing the Legislative Assembly to be more radical, while at the same time, they're both cultivating street-level organizations across the kingdom. Cordelier clubs, Jacobin clubs, those kinds of things.
And what are they trying to do with those?
They are trying to win power for themselves, for their constituents. They're trying to overturn the Constitution of 1791, and many of them are trying to get rid of the king altogether.
So what you're seeing, so what we're seeing here is the people who are as part of the system at this stage in the game are not satisfied with their share of power in the system.
Right.
So they're going to start to radicalize folks in order to start violence, in order to basically overthrow the system.
Yeah, and if you would argue it from their perspective, what you would say is they tried it the right way, right? And I'm doing air quotes around the right way. They did it through peace. They had a relatively peaceful process of creating the Constitution of 1791, right? That's the right way. And they ended up with nothing. Yes, they had some equality before the law, but they have no right to participate in the political system. As I said, to them, to the average person on the street, in the fields, all they've done is exchange an aristocracy of birth for an aristocracy of wealth. Which, in fairness, France is for most of the 19th century after all this calms down. It becomes an aristocracy of wealth, kind of ironically. So 1792 is the real turning point, and a couple important things happen that year. One of them is that the Jacobins and Girondins succeed by the end of the year in overthrowing the Constitution. In August, large numbers of popular revolts happen, in particular in Paris. They storm the Tuileries Palace. There's a great painting of it, not for the first or last time. The Swiss Guard there is massacred. They take the king into captivity along with the queen, Marie Antoinette, who is worth pointing out, contra Sofia Coppola's movie, was very involved in politics. She was very smart. She was very savvy. She just ended up on the wrong side of this one. He's put into prison. The Constitution is abrogated, and now we create a new constitution, a popular constitution.
And who is in charge? Who is writing this?
So we have basically taken the English Constitution and ripped the monarchy out of it. France, after 1792, will be a unicameral legislative government. There is no executive.
And who is running this organization?
What's now referred to as the... there's a lot of different names for it, but the National Convention is a legislature that runs the country.
Okay. And this is perhaps a good time to kind of bring up the question because of the whole the concept of legitimacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So before the revolution kicked off in 1785, to pick a year,
yeah,
legitimacy came from the monarchy who got it from God.
Yes.
The king was the king, and he had the power to do so because God said so. There's more details than that, but for our purposes, that's good.
Yeah.
Where is the source of legitimacy now? Is there one?
So this is a great question, and this is kind of the core question that people later, like Max Weber, will ask about this process. From where does legitimacy originate? From where do rights originate? Especially if we're moving out from a kind of Christian Catholic cosmology, which has a very specific answer for that. But of course, not everybody is Christian or Catholic, so you can't always rely on that. The answer is nobody actually knows. And what happens is that France kind of descends into chaos. The other thing that happens in 1792 is war is declared. Basically, by mid-1792, everybody kind of, really without exception, assumes that war is the answer to these problems. The royalists assume that the Prussians and Austrians will save the monarchy. The radicals on the left assume that war will bring an expansion of the revolution.
They can bring the revolution to other folks and will allow them to consolidate power.
Right, exactly. Turns out the radicals were right, and then eventually, a few decades later, the royalists were right. But there's a person who happens in between. So it's 1792, as I said, it's a wild year, and it's the year that the country descends into chaos.
So we have the constitutional monarchy.
Yep.
Which then is overthrown, essentially, by a group using a mob.
Right, and now it's a republic.
And the people in charge are basically staying in power through mob tactics.
Yeah, to some extent. And I don't think we need to exaggerate the mob element of it. There are functional government institutions at the national, provincial, and local levels. The problem is now, and this is another Max Weber idea, now that you have uncorked the specter of political violence, it's really hard to put that back in the bag.
And it's really easy to use if you have the right resources.
Yes. So what ends up happening is a couple different groups emerge during this period. One of them is the kind of the central group of Jacobins, led by people like Robespierre, who they may have heard of. Another guy named Saint-Just, who becomes his nickname, the Angel of Death. They both serve on a committee that is essentially an executive committee, what's often referred to as the 12. There's another committee. There's kind of two committees that basically run the state. There's a judicial group led by a guy named Fouquier Tinville, who becomes kind of the executioner of the revolution.
This is the Committee for Public Safety.
Yeah, the Committee for Public Safety is the one Robespierre is on. There's also a Committee of General Security. There's a Revolutionary Tribunal. One of the mistakes people make when they look at this period is they assume it's a dictatorship by Robespierre, but it's not. It's a group of 12 on the Committee for Public Safety that changes. It's not the same 12 people.
So this is a snake pit.
Yeah, it's imagine, to go back to our January 6th idea, you know, a lot of people have debated what that meant and what its goals were. But imagine if you went into the crowd that went into the Capitol on January 6th and you found the five most radical people. Find their 200 friends, let them run the government. That's what's happening during this period. On top of that, there are other groups. The Girondins are still around. The royalists have kind of they fled, by and large, including Louis's sons who flee, two of whom will later become kings, Louis the 18th and then Charles the 10th, the last two of the mainline Bourbon kings, along with lots of other former nobles. But there are still groups in France fighting for control. At the same time, the Allies, who are now Austria, Prussia, and a couple other countries, they have invaded. By late summer of 1792, there is a foreign army on French soil.
So we've got a government that is basically a snake pit of competing interests and priorities who are basically trying to make things happen, but also trying to assert personal power.
Right.
While you have a international war going on, the only way to stay in power is to exercise violence.
Yes. This stuff is really hard to figure out when there's no other crises. There are several crises happening now, right? And it's not going to get any better. So the revolution is saved by this loose amalgamation of old royalist army troops and some volunteers, but also some conscripts. It's a weird army in 1792. There's a great book on it called From Yorktown to Valmy by Samuel Scott. So they throw this army in front of the Prussians and Austrians, and they actually win. They actually win a battle at Valmy. It's not really a battle. The Prussians
artillery
have,
duel.
Yeah, the Prussians have a lot of dysentery, and they're at the end of their supply chain. They shoot a lot of cannon at each other. There's a windmill. But this is the great victory, right? The revolution has been saved. This is one of the turning points. If the Allies had managed to be coherent and invaded France and taken Paris, probably ends the revolution. They don't. They retreat. Now we have a war, the War of the First Coalition. We have a republic, and we got some civil wars. So what happens as we go into the next year, into 1793, is there's a civil war first between the Girondins and the Jacobins. So they had worked together to get rid of the Royalists. Now the Jacobins get rid of the Girondins. And they turn on the Girondins, and people like Danton, who's one of the great orators of the revolution, and they also set up the guillotine. And if you have ever been to Paris, if you walk out of the Louvre through the Luxembourg Gardens and you walk out into the Place de la Concorde, which is the giant traffic circle with the two fountains on it, that's where the guillotine was. You'd never know it, because to France today, the revolution is kind of like their Nazi period, even though they had an actual Nazi period later. But that's where it was.
And the entire city was rebuilt by Napoleon III, if I'm not
mistaken. Yeah, a lot of the city was rebuilt by the interior minister Haussmann in the 1850s and 60s. But yeah, that's where it was. So there's a civil war between the Jacobins and the Girondins. There's also the war going on outside. So the revolution was saved at Valmy in 1792, but very quickly that ragtag army starts to fail. And the coalition grows. So the coalition is going to add eventually Spain, England, and a few other countries. Basically, every country in Western Europe becomes involved in the anti-French First Coalition.
And if I remember properly, there are also some external provinces in open revolt, the Vendée.
Well, one of the other things that happens is, so as the central government becomes more radical, parts of the country decide they don't like that. Some of it is old, you know, center versus periphery rivalries. Some of it is a very specific problem. So you mentioned the Vendée, which becomes notorious. The Vendée is in central western France. It's below Brittany, so that peninsula that sticks off the west side.
Over in Bordeaux?
Yeah, north of Bordeaux.
Okay.
The Vendée is a very conservative place. And one of the other things that the revolution did in 1790 is it nationalized the Catholic Church. A former bishop named Talleyrand wrote a document that said basically what Henry VIII did to the Catholic Church in England in the 1500s. The church is now nationalized. It's all national property. The churches will be owned by the state. The state will pay priests, and the priests have to swear an oath of loyalty to the government, which is kind of the opposite of the way America went during that same period. The people of the Vendée, very conservative, very religious, they don't like this. People of the Vendée also are fighters. So they open a revolt. And as the civil war in Paris grows more contentious, as more and more people go to the guillotine as enemies of the state, as the committee and the Jacobins declare a reign of terror, they use that phrase, more and more cities and provinces revolt. So now you have another layer of problems. You have several kinds of civil war. You have the foreign war. And you have these Jacobins who are trying to write a constitution in the midst of all of this chaos and upheaval and now mass bloodshed, including the trial and execution of Louis and Marie Antoinette in 1793. They are both executed. There's now no longer a monarch around, even if somebody wanted one.
All right, so where to now? Because you just laid out an immensely difficult problem.
Yeah, and so the problem will not be solved for a while. The Jacobins are both kind of chaotic, but also very intelligent about the power they have. So they have the ability to enact some very radical laws because of the chaos. So what they do over the course of 1793 and the first half of 1794 is they become more and more radical in their processes by basically requisitioning the resources of the state. In August of 1793, they issue a requisition of what's known as the Levée en Masse, where it says all of the resources of the state are at the service of the government. And there's this famous, almost lyrical statement in it. The young men will go to war, the married men will work in factories, the women will, and children will make, you know, lint and gun cotton. And
the old guys will tell stories.
The old men will take to public squares to preach the hatred of kings, right? It's a great teaching lesson, and it's as I said, it's almost lyrical. This is radical, right? So a country like let's use Prussia, for example. I don't know, ballpark 10 million people. The Prussian field army in 1793, they can maybe put a field army together of 100,000 men, maybe a couple other armies of 50,000. I mean, you can do the math on that, right? If their total military establishment is 300,000 men and a population of 10 million, and a lot of those are not Prussian, they're foreigners, imagine the power France has to take 28 million people and put them into a war effort. You know, you're a World War II scholar. You know what a
yeah.
a society mobilized for war looks like.
And this is traditionally one of the first instances that people point back to of a complete mobilization.
Yes, and it is far from complete, just like the World War II mobilization was far from complete. For example, they generally don't put women in uniform.
But in matters of degree, we're talking orders of magnitude different than anything we've seen previous.
By 1794, there are 11 French field armies and probably 800,000 people in uniform. Again, a country like Prussia only has around 300,000, and only about 180,000 of those can fight, you know, on a front at a given time. This solves the problems pretty quickly. So this levée en masse, and there's I'm kind of glossing some of the other manpower and mobilization efforts, but they're happening. So the manpower and the mobilization of resources, material resources for the state as well, those enable them to knock down the internal revolts quickly. The exception is the Vendée, where basically a genocide happens. They send a general named Hoche out there, and at a certain point he's putting people in ships and just sinking the ships. He's killing thousands of people at once. People in the Vendée still remember this. But with the exception of the Vendée, the internal revolts get put down pretty quickly, and the war turns pretty quickly as well by the next year in 1794.
And they start to have battlefield successes. This is where Napoleon starts to make a name for himself, but not mm-hmm. just Napoleon. There are other French generals. I don't know if marshal is the correct term to use for this era, but the idea of there's French arms are starting to see some success.
Yeah, and the thing that the abolition of nobility really did was, prior to the revolution, to be an officer, you had to be a noble. The abolition of nobility allowed talent to rise through the ranks, as well, again, as Lieutenant Colonel retired Bill Nance, combat veteran, knows, combat has a way of getting rid of incompetent leaders. So the fighting that takes place in this War of the First Coalition winnows the French army to the point where it is very experienced and very good by 1794. And you rightly point out, you know, we're not even to Napoleon yet, but you got plenty of leaders who are good fighters. People like a Jourdan, who's going to win a great victory in what is now, I think it's technically Belgium in 1794. Yes, he participated in a genocide. Hoche is also a good general when he's fighting a traditional war and, you know, not mass murdering people. People like Andre Massena in Italy, the guys who are down fighting in Spain. So this turns the war around on the front. And I'm going to take the war up another year. By 1795, the war has really turned. Prussia leaves the war. Spain leaves the war. In fact, Spain will become a French ally. This is how France gets Louisiana Territory back to then later sell to America. And it's basically just Austria and England that they're still fighting after 1795. Now, the problem is we have not fixed the internal issues. So
we have a crust, but a squishy center.
Well, the problem is the people running the state become more and more radical as they find more and more people to repress and murder. So come the summer of 1794, as the armies are winning the war, if picture the end of Dune Part 2, where Stilgar and the Fremen are waiting to go on their holy war, and then Paul says go, and then they go, and then they conquer the great houses quickly. That's what the French army's doing, but back home, the terror is heating up. And Robespierre and the other Jacobins are increasingly repressive once a lot of their enemies are dead. In the summer of 1794, there's what's known as the Great Terror. Probably 40,000 people die in Paris alone, much less in other places. The city of Lyon is pretty comprehensively destroyed, or at least parts of it. So people are kind of tired of the Jacobins by the summer. So there's a revolt against the Jacobins in what's known as Thermidor, what's called the Thermidorian Reaction. Robespierre, Saint-Just, and several of the other Jacobin ringleaders are rounded up, guillotined, and the committee is dismantled. Now, the convention doesn't go anywhere. We're still going to have the convention, except what they're going to do is they're going to create an executive body called the Directory. And now we're going to transition to the longest lived of the governments. The Directory lasts from 1794 until 1799. It's kind of a kleptocracy. I think perhaps the guy who is most identified with the Directory is a guy named Paul Baha. And Baha he's smart, he's savvy, he's an operator. I think we all know the person that's around who like always has some kind of hustle going on. That's Baha. Baha finds Napoleon, actually. So it's people like Baha who now take over. They're survivors, but they're also people who, you know, they're kind of on the take too. So the Directory calms things down. And I think the Directory is underappreciated. In large part because it is a kleptocracy, but it does also function as a government. It is arguably the most functional of the revolutionary governments. The problem is that the different ideas and the different factions haven't gone away. So once the Directory comes into power, the Jacobins are repressed, Jacobin clubs are banned, many of the leading Jacobins are guillotined. All of the other groups kind of come back. There's a white terror. The Royalists come back in 1795, and they kind of keep coming back over the next few years. There are people who are even more radical. So there's a guy named Gracchus Babeuf running around. He has what he calls the Society of Friends. And Babeuf wants to eliminate private property. Babeuf is the first communist. He gets guillotined, because of course. But that is where the idea of communism kind of originates, modern communism, with Babeuf. So what we've done up to this point is we have kind of experimented with a bunch of different kinds of government. And none of them really works given the realities of the situation. From this point on, it's now a question of, all right, we've passed the crisis. By 1795, there is no French army fighting on French soil. The revolution has now carried the flag to other places. In fact, conquered territory. So the Low Countries are now part of France. No, not technically, but virtually.
They're occupied.
Yeah, they're a satellite ally of France. And everywhere the revolutionary armies go, they plant the revolution and upend the existing social political structures. The problem is the European states, they're not really cooperating. They're busy dividing Poland between them. At this point, they couldn't stop it, so they just kind of let it run. So that doesn't change the chaos at home, it just makes it less frequent. Sometimes old Jacobins rise up. Sometimes Royalists rise up. Sometimes Royalists win elections, and there's more than one election result nullified because the Royalists won. The other thing that happens at this point, it's really important for us as military historians, is the armies are going further and further from France. And the military is an interesting organization. We have a lesson here at CGSC that's crafted around exactly how you fight a revolutionary army. Because you have an inherent problem with it. The problem is the values of the revolution, individual, freedom, agency, liberty, are not the values of the military, which are discipline, hierarchy, and obedience to orders, right? So all throughout the revolution, people involved with the military have been discussing and debating these points. And they tried a couple of times to do radical democratic things in the military. So they tried electing officers at one point.
There's that book, was it Berthaud?
Yeah.
The Army of the French Revolution, which talks about all those details there. Mm-hmm. So as the Army's continuing on, that's almost a whole podcast in of itself.
Well, yeah, and it's a great topic, and the Berto book is great. But the solution for it is they realize they have to compromise. What they do is they take the traditional discipline structure and say, all right, we're keeping that. What we're going to do is we're going to plug the manpower from the levee en masse into it. And in fact, they create a national conscription system in 1798.
The Jourdan laws.
Right. Our old friend Jourdan creates it. And they're also going to eliminate the requirement that used to exist to be noble to advance. So now, if you're good, you get to be promoted. Or, if we're being honest, the way it is in every military throughout all of time, if you're good and you know people, you get advanced, right? Militaries will never be truly egalitarian in that regard. But they mostly get it right. So that makes the military a really potent weapon. It also makes the military an example of what the state is not doing. Because the military has figured out the compromise. It's figured out the balance between security and liberty. The state hasn't. And so you have all these uprisings. The French call them days, journées, like the famous one of Vendémiaire, where a mob gathers. It almost overthrows the government, but a couple of generals, Napoleon being one of them, another guy named Murat, a cavalry commander, they stop it, mostly by killing people. Horses are very good for putting down mobs. But the army is getting further and further away from Paris. You got armies in what is now the Netherlands. You got armies in Italy. The armies in Spain have long ago left. You got armies in what is now Germany. And they're going forward, and they're looking back at Paris, and they're thinking, hey, what are you guys doing back there? We've got no money. We've got no supplies. The only money and supplies we get are the ones we capture for ourselves. And at a certain point, like, the money we're sending back to you is running the state.
Well, there's the famous, now this is a couple of years later, but this is the famous Napoleon quote where, as he's talking to his army before they go into Sardinia.
In Italy, yeah.
Up in Italy,
yeah.
Where they're sitting there going, soldiers of the Army of Italy, before
you're naked, ill-fed, ill-clothed,
And basically along the lines of, follow me, boys, and we're going to get rich.
He's not wrong. So Napoleon emerges from obscurity in 1795. He's kind of Baha's boy. His reward is that he's given the Army of Italy in 1796, which is stalled out. The main effort is on the Rhine in Germany. What Napoleon discovers really quickly is that he's a military genius. And over the course of 1796, he conquers Italy.
Northern Italy.
Well, even southern Italy, for the most part. It's not fully conquered. But yeah, most of mainland Italy by the end of 1796, early 1797. And what Napoleon realizes is what a lot of other generals had realized, which is those guys back in Paris don't actually know what they're doing. So there are several generals who are looking around saying, man, we can do this stuff well. Like, I can go to Italy. I can go to the Netherlands. I can take an army. I can conquer a country. I can hand them a constitution and say, congratulations, you are now a republic. And it works. Why can't those people back in Paris do that? So this is where the power brokers like Baha start to look for a military leader. By the late 1790s, it is very clear that the military is going to have a major role in politics. And this is a challenge every state faces down, right? How does the military influence politics? Napoleon, after Italy, is one of the leaders of somebody who could become the military part of the government. The War of the First Coalition actually ends in Italy. Napoleon brokers the treaty that ends the war, along with winning so much stuff that he loots from Italy. Not necessarily illegally. It is permissible at the time to take stuff from conquered countries.
Northern Italy is extremely rich.
Right. So it's not looted in the modern sense, but he does take a lot of Italian wealth and export it back to France. Although not the Mona Lisa, that was brought by Leonardo da Vinci himself. But we haven't solved the core problem. So war has ended. By mid-1797, there's technically no war. There's a very real chance there's going to be a military coup next. Not a popular coup, not a royalist coup, but a military coup. So Talleyrand devises this plan to get Napoleon out of France, because he's the one they're worried about. He's ambitious. So they send him to Egypt. And Napoleon will land in Egypt in 1798, and he will conquer Egypt pretty quickly from the Mamluks. He will then go fight the Ottomans around Jaffa for a while, and then he'll go back to Cairo.
Lose his fleet.
Yeah, he will lose his fleet. What this does is it sparks a new coalition. So the War of the Second Coalition starts after Napoleon lands. And the Second Coalition is going to be missing Prussia and Spain, but it's going to gain Russia and the Ottomans. And Russia is the real prize there. So as Napoleon is lost in Egypt, not shooting the nose off the Sphinx, that had been lost a long time ago.
But finding the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, yes. One of his scholars did find the Rosetta Stone. The coalition assembles new armies, and they fight again. And this time, because of a lot of different things, in large part a loss of manpower, this is why the Jordan Law is passed, a kind of a brain drain. Some of the leaders had either died or left service. The war does not go in France's favor. Napoleon stalls out in the Levant. The Russians, there's a Russian general named Suvorov, hits Italy like a comet. In fact, he reconquers Italy for the coalition faster than Napoleon had conquered it in 1796, and then decides he doesn't like the Austrians and goes home. So things are not looking great for France. It looks like things might go badly for France. At that point, Napoleon abandons his army in Italy. You know, say what you want about Napoleon for or against. He left his army in Italy.
In
Egypt, and goes back home. At this point, there's another coup, and this one succeeds. So it's known as the coup of 18 Brumaire. What people like Baha and Abbé Sieyès had wanted to do is they wanted to set up Napoleon as a figurehead. They assumed, all right, he's a general, he knows nothing about politics. In many cases, that's a fair assumption at the time. It is a bad assumption on Napoleon's part. Napoleon's brother, Lucien, is one of the leaders in the Congress, in the legislature. So he manages a coup attempt where essentially the army takes control of the legislature. And Napoleon and his brother, along with Baha and the other folks, set up a government known as the Consulate. And the idea is that there will be three consuls. The military general, Napoleon, will be the first consul, but all the power will be with the second and third consuls. This is what the civilians expect. Well, when Napoleon shows up and hands them his plan, it turns out they're the figureheads, and Napoleon, first consul, is running the state. They didn't expect that, but at this point, it's kind of a fait accompli. So in late 1799, Napoleon takes charge of the state. For most people, this is where the revolution ends. We're now in the Napoleonic period. Technically, the revolution continues, the consulate continues with France as a republic until Napoleon crowns himself emperor in late 1804, so another 5 years.
So where do you snap the chalk line?
So I think it's, for one, I don't think the distinction matters all that much. I generally accord with the majority. I think it's fine to say 1799. I think in large part because what Napoleon does is a capstone to the revolution, but it's also not revolutionary in many ways. So I'll give you a couple examples of that. Napoleon issues a law code. It's known as the Code Napoleon. And parts of it are still in force in France, as well as Louisiana, because it was the French territory at the time. It's regressive compared to the French revolutionary governments for the most part. So, for example, divorce had been a one-party assent activity. Now it returns to being a two-party assent, meaning a woman can no longer divorce her husband without his permission. That's what two-party really means. That's seen as being regressive. Now, it's still more progressive than most countries in Europe, but it's a rollback from where we were 5 years prior. He reinstitutionalizes the church through what's known as the Concordat. That's decided right around 1800. Because he understood that people like their religion. And no matter what the revolutionaries thought, people were not going to set aside their religion at the drop of a hat. A lesson he will later mess up himself when he goes into Spain. So Napoleon in some ways is the apogee or the completion of the revolution, which is what he's called himself. But in some ways, he's kind of his own thing. And so I think it's okay to periodize by saying the revolution, doing air quotes, ends in 1799, and the Napoleonic period begins then.
So we've kind of taken this through in a couple different ways. We've looked at it as a kind of a noble power struggle, which then transforms into a power struggle between the different
different states, political factions,
and then we start shifting into a bourgeoisie form, where now it's a different power struggle, basically different power factions striving against each other, devolving further and further into chaos, and then kind of coming out of it with the directorate, and then ending with a military coup.
Yeah,
a lot to cover in about 10 years worth of history, right?
Yeah.
So with that said, kind of two questions. First off, what's the best way to chunk this? Is it by government? Is it by theme? Because there are a couple different ways that you and I have both been trained to look at this. How do you approach it?
Yeah, I think there's kind of three different ways to do it. Two of them political and one of them kind of social. The political one, which is the one I think you find in most textbooks, is you slice it by what government is in charge, right? So royal government to 1789, a national assembly to 1791, legislative assembly to 1792, directory to 1794, a convention to 1794, directory to 1799, consulate and then empire. So again, that's kind of the textbook way to do it. I think that's the way that Mike Leggeri taught both of us. He probably learned from Dr. Donald Horward, his mentor. The social way to do it, and I think it's probably fair to call this the Georges Lefebvre way, the great historian of Marxist historian of the revolution, is by what social group is in charge. So I kind of characterize it this way at the beginning. So you have an aristocratic revolt, then a bourgeois government, then a popular government, then another bourgeois government, and then whatever Napoleon is doing. The way I like to do it, and I think the simplest way to look at it, especially for people who are not going to get into the weeds of the exact details of who's doing what, when, and why, is just what kind of government is in charge, right? So monarchy up to 1789, and then I think it's fair to call it a constitutional monarchy until 1792, then a republic until 1799, then you have a military dictatorship.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground on this one. So mm-hmm. Let's kind of just wrap this up with a short, because it's almost a podcast in of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So why do we care about something that happened nigh on 200 something years ago?
Yeah, and this is the question you asked at the beginning, and is the question. What does the French Revolution mean? And I will borrow a phrase from one of the great early revolutionary documents, a text called Qu'est-ce que c'est la tiers état? What is the third estate? And the answer that is in that book is everything. And the French Revolution is everything. One of the reasons the French Revolution matters, one of the reasons it is the as I said, the important world historical event between the rise of Protestant Christianity and the 20th century, however you want to slice that, is it contains pretty much every possible relationship between people and their government, between the social and political aspects of existence. Whether it's Gracchus Babeuf's communists, whether it's absolutist monarchy, military dictatorship, whatever, it's there. So the French Revolution is a microcosm of humanity, and particularly humanity at the intersection of the human, the social, the political, and the military. Although I have to say, a lot of times the historians forget the military part. And a lot of military historians forget the other parts.
And the conflict between aspirations and practicality.
Yeah, I mean,
just straight up power.
Yeah, we're children of the post 9/11 period. We had a lot of these same debates in America. The balance between security and liberty, right? They had all of them in the 1790s. And again, let's not mistake how important this was. The fact that this happened in the largest, most populous, wealthiest, and arguably the most important country in Europe, maybe in the world at the time, most important country in the world, at least in the world controlled by Europeans, which is most of the world, the fact that it happened there is really important because it becomes a touchstone. One of the other things that makes the French Revolution important is it gives the model for revolution. People do not follow the American revolutionary model because it wasn't really a revolution. It was an anti-colonial war with a lot of help from an outside force, the French.
One might even say an insurrection.
Yeah, there were insurrection elements to it, yeah. But when people are thinking
insurgency,
about...
Insurgency, there we go.
Yeah. When people are thinking about how to do a revolution internally, it's the French model they choose. Because, of course, the Americans weren't trying to do an internal revolution. They're trying to throw off an external power. So it gives the model for that. And I'll give you a couple examples. The idea of a national flag comes from the French Revolution, the tricolor. That is, it comes from the colors of the city of Paris, red and blue, with the white stripe for the royal family. The idea of a national anthem comes from the French Revolution. During the early years of the war, a group of troops from Marseille walk into the capital, ready to fight, singing a song that they made up. So people started calling it La Marseillaise. It's now the French national anthem. So the idea of a national anthem comes from the French Revolution. We don't realize a lot of times that when we talk about political theory and social theory, it almost always has some kind of tie back to the revolution. So again, I mentioned Karl Marx earlier. When Marx thought about history, and Marx was a historian, we tend to think of him as an economist, but he called himself a historian. He looked at the French Revolution.
Our very concept of left and right.
Yeah. Yeah, they come from the French Revolutionary legislatures, where the liberals sat on the left and the conservatives sat on the right. There's this great scene in Abel Gance's Napoleon where he has his camera sway back and forth over the legislature as they're having a debate. And I think it's so the French Revolution is a touchstone for all of this stuff, and it unleashed these forces on the world. The other thing that's important, I think that's not worth glossing over, French history is dramatic. That's one of the things that I think people often miss. The events of French history almost always come with an almost TV-ready sense of drama, right? Like you referenced Jeanne d'Arc earlier. There is no more dramatic event in French and maybe human history than a country that's about to be conquered by a foreign power. And then this random girl shows up and decides she's going to be a general. And then she kind of wins the war, right? That happens in the French Revolution, too. And it's not just a series of dry technical political debates. There's all kinds of drama to it. And yet you hear this with the Marseillaise, the national anthem. The Marseillaise belongs to that time. It's a violent song. If you look at the lyrics, it talks about blood soaking the furrows of French fields, right? But you can't really make a modern adaptation of the Marseillaise. You kind of have to do it the way they did it, because it belongs to that time, and it roots us in that time and place in a way that other national anthems that are kind of more generic marches don't really do. So I think that there is I'm biased, I'm a French historian, but I think there's a drama or even a melodrama to French history that's attractive in a way that other examples of change or debate, they don't quite have the same resonance.
Awesome. Well, we could keep going on about the French Revolution. With much of our same stuff, but I think this has been a fascinating point, and I think this is a good place to call it. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.